This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Welcome, everyone, to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. My name is Michael Walker, and I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Mark. How are you this week, Mark?
I'm very well, Walker. How are you?
I'm very good. Another great week of games. Another great day to do a podcast.
It's a wonderful day to do a podcast, Walker. Today is International Trans Day of Visibility.
Nice.
Happy Trans Day of Visibility to you, Walker, and to everyone, to all our trans listeners, to all our non-binary listeners, to all our queer listeners generally, but especially on today of all days, to those trans members of the board game community. And we're here, we see you.
Our town thawed out just for them. They brought the heat, Mark. All right, first we're going to talk about the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago. Then the games we played this week, the news and why it doesn't matter, and the topic this week, which is games from the 20th century.
Specifically, Euros from the 20th century.
Where we just get to sit back and gush about how great it all used to be.
Okay, not all, necessarily. I don't want to be one of those people.
No.
There are a lot of mediocre Euros in the 20th century, but there's a certain set of observations that I've had occasion to reflect on. And again, not all of it is good. But increasingly, I think that there's been an evolution of the term, and very interested to hear your thoughts.
So the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago, our Eurus for this week, is Archaeos Society.
Yeah, Archaeos Society. I've never really come to terms with Archaeos Society, frankly.
True, Ethnos came out.
Yes,
and then
this is true.
Then
this
it
is,
was,
not, this
then
is
it,
a true
then,
fact.
Then it was Ethnos for, I don't know, a while, like almost. Maybe.
Ethnos for a while.
10 years, maybe.
No, much less than that.
Less than that?
Less than that.
And then Archaeos Society for a year, and now they're putting out Ethnos again.
Ethnos again.
So all the Ethnos. Because apparently they didn't like Archaeos Society, I guess, and decided...
It's strange. It's one of those things where, and this happens sometimes, you have a redevelopment or a reissue of a game, and sometimes it's just that the new theming saps your excitement for it. I think part of that is true of Archaeos Society, but part of it is also you improve some of the core mechanisms and you make them tighter, and you look at it and say, but now it's not as fun. It was better before when it was slightly unbalanced and weird. I don't know. It's weird. Like we talked about this when we reviewed Archaeos Society. I think what's very telling is that since reviewing Archaeos Society, we have not played it, but... Part of this is availability. We have had occasion to play Ethnos since. So there's that. This is not a function of my efforts, but so maybe it's just distribution? I don't know. Archaeos Society is awkward. It had a lot of the charm of Ethnos, but not all of it.
And that was the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago. Now on to the games we played last week. Mark, what did you get to play?
I played Ethnos. Entirely randomly. I didn't suggest it. It just came up. We were in a position where we had 6 players and we wanted something not over long. Ethnos is never... I think Ethnos is longer than people remember it. This is actually one of my problems with both Ethnos and Archaeos Society. If it were reliably 45 to 60 minutes, I would like it a lot better. But even when you're moving at a good clip, it's reliably closer to 75.
I was about to say, the flow is so good that the time does not seem as long.
Exactly. But by the time you're rounding up the third round, frequently the scores don't change a whole heck of a lot between the second and third round. And another criticism that I have of Ethnos, for what it's worth, is you really have to know what you're getting into in terms of player count. Because if you're playing with 6 players, it's one of those circumstances where the volume of components is out of proportion to the volume of points that are going to get disgorged. What do I mean by this? I mean, there's this board, and you play bands to put pieces out on the board, and the board will not constitute the bulk of your scores, especially if you've got dwarves in play or halflings in play, because big sets are what are going to determine who wins in Ethnos at six players, in my experience. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't compete over the points on the board, but if you spend too much time and effort on those points, you're going to get eclipsed by those people who have a very small number of tokens on the board, but have these a lot of five sets, a lot of six sets. That's what's going to be, because the diminishing returns set in hard when you're six players competing over the same group of points. Anyway, in this game, though, that having been said, the trolls were in play. And so the trolls, similarly, because they help break ties in the area majority competition of Ethnos, are also very important in the context of scoring points there. So if you can secure a good troll token early on, then yeah, it's worth putting some effort into getting out more tokens onto the board, because you're not going to have to worry about those three-way ties of two tokens each for that six-point province, right? Rather than everyone getting 2 points, the trolls will help show up and say Pixar didn't happen. Or spouting conspiracy theories, and suddenly you've got 6 points and nobody else has anything.
Was there orc board?
No orc board.
No orc board.
There was the merfolk board, which is also fun, but again, the merfolk board leans into the area majority aspect. So I look at this and I figure, okay, you've been around the Ethnos one or two times. You've been to more than one race war in your life, Mark. And the trolls were in play and the dwarves were in play. So I figure, okay, that's it. I play a troll set relatively early on, and then I just play as big a set as I can with dwarves, and that was it. And so quality decision-making, not so much. More about identifying the lay of the land. It felt a little bit like Dominion, actually. You see the 10 action cards that are there. You make your decision what you're going to buy, and then you go for it, and you adapt to whatever cards are available in the context of Ethnos, or you adapt to whatever your hand happens to be in the context of Dominion. This all makes it sound pretty negative, and indeed, from a thoroughgoing strategic decision-making point of view, it is. But as Walker observes, solid flow can make up for a lot. And so it was enjoyable watching people jockey and moaning when someone takes the card that somebody else wants, and then you're hoping for the dragons to come out because you want the round to end, or trying to figure out whether the round's going to last long enough for you to play out that one last set. There's still lots of interesting moments of tension to be had in Ethnos, but as I say, when you're playing with six, you look at the races available, you can make a couple of educated guesses, and the game played out almost exactly as I thought it might, and I am no great strategic genius. I've given up making predictions since 2016, but I played enough games of Ethnos that I can see how things are going to shake out. I will say, though, that contra a lot of the gaming public, I really like the John Howe artwork. I really appreciate the card design is a little archaic looking, but I do appreciate the artwork.
Yeah, I like it. It has that raw feel to it, right? Where you have that hand of cards and you just need those two more cards. You know the dragons are coming, you're going to push your luck, and then the round ends and you're stuck with all these cards in your hand. Anyway.
I agree. It's got some very good push your luck tension. And the new edition, which is coming out sometime this year, Anthropomorphic Animals.
Oofed.
I feel like they're, no pun intended, I feel like they're on the tail end of that trend. We've been doing Pledge of Indifference the past few weeks, and I can't help but notice that this could just be a blip, or a dead cat bounce, if you will. Again, no pun intended. I keep stumbling into these. I can't help but notice that there's been a marked decrease in the number of games with anthropomorphic animals on crowdfunding, as well as a marked decrease in the aggressive use of the word cozy in marketing copy. I don't know if this is going to persist, but we'll see. Anyway, that was Ethnos, designed by Paolo Mori, originally published by Simon in 2017.
They're building up for it, Mark. There's going to be an anthropomorphic game called The Coziest Cozy That Cozied the Coz. And it'll be all about it's going to be great.
I think there's a reason why you're a board game critic and not a board game designer, Walker.
It's going to be a great game.
What have you been playing this week?
Mark, you and I got to play Bookie Bookie Pew Pew. I hate sand because it gets everywhere. Wizards of the Grimoire, Shifting Sands.
I feel like for purposes of clarity, I should emphasize that it's actually called Wizards of the Grimoire, Shifting Sands. All those other things are just what Walker calls it.
This is designed by Cole Banning and Joel Banning and put out by Grimoire Games. And it is a two-player dueling, ramp up your spells, try to kill your opponent before they kill you.
It is a combo-building, drafting card battler thing where you're just trying to whittle down your opponent's life. a la Star Realms, but rather than using deck building, as I said, it's about hand management and combo building. In particular, you're going to often want some number of spells out in front of you that do damage, because that's how you win. But also, if you just pick damage-dealing spells, you're going to find that you don't have enough mana, and you're waiting too much for those damage-dealing spells to go off cooldown. So then you can start getting these really cool combos with other spells that either give you more mana or relocate mana and help you manage the cooldown of things. And those interactions, I think, are where Wizards of the Grimoire shine.
Yeah, you get a new spell every turn. You get to pick from this large pool of spells. You take one, another one comes in, and you add it to your tableau, and you're allowed to have six spells in your tableau. And when you use these spells, you pile a bunch of mana on top. And then every time it becomes your turn again, you get to remove one. So big spells are going to be out for two or three rounds. So you want spells, like Mark said, that let you shift that mana around and let you open up those spells, get them back faster, and sort of like craft these interesting combos to try to tick your opponent down faster. Because a lot of the games that we have played, it seems that you always win that one turn before your opponent does. So getting that one key combo off is very important.
It's interesting. Some people appreciate when a game is designed such that everyone is reliably one turn away from victory when the game ends. Some people see that as a sign of a game that is perhaps overtuned. I am agnostic. I don't really mind when games allow for blowouts. I also don't mind when games allow for always close finishes if it doesn't feel forced. If it's obvious that there's rubber banding going on, like very aggressive, very blunt mechanisms, a la Power Grid in terms of resolving turn order, things of that nature, I tend to object a little bit. But in the context of Bookie Bookie Pew Pew, it just leads to a tense photo finish every time. So I don't object in the slightest. I really like the variety of spells. In a given game, you're only going to see a fraction of the available spells. And now that there are two base games, Shifting Sands and just Wizards of the Grimoire, there's a huge library of available things. There are no rules baked in that allow you to combine the two sets. I have to assume that there's some intended balance of utility spells and damaging spells just so that the game can proceed at a decent clip. But every game of the system that I've played has been very satisfying and very interesting in terms of trying to jockey and respond to what my opponent's doing, as well as building my own combo. So it's not super interactive, but it is somewhat reactive in terms of what's being drafted by your opponent. And I appreciate the system. It's bone simple, but in the best possible way. So you get to see and play with a lot of toys. It's a really compelling two-player game in my experience.
Yeah, I love the fact that you can always do this basic attack where you play, you know, you sort of keep your highest mana card. And
you love them basic attacks.
You get to lightning your opponent in the face for the four. But then there are spells that sort of modify that, which I really enjoy. Like, you know, build up mana cards on this, which will add to your big punch at the end of the round. Anyway, that kind of stuff I find interesting.
Yeah, so this was the second kind of expandalone set of Wizards of the Grimoire. It was successfully crowdfunded and fulfilled recently. This is a review copy we got from the publishers. Wizards of the Grimoire, Shifting Sands. I get to play Jenga Maker. Now, Walker, let me paint a scene, all right? We've got a certain number of hardcore hobbyists, right?
Mark, put a little tree down there. A little tree. A little friendly tree. Sorry, you're painting a picture. I always want a friendly tree down there. Sorry, go ahead.
When Bob Ross was talking about happy accidents, he wasn't talking about you. Oh. You're one of those unhappy ones.
Oh.
We've got some serious hobby gamers. I'm at somebody else's home. I look at their game collection and say, oh, let's play Jenga Maker. And the one who owns Jenga Maker is like, yeah, Jenga Maker. A couple of other hobbyist gamers are like, yeah, sure. I guess we'll all just be playing with dolls and action figures today. Jenga. Well, it's like, trust me, Jenga Maker is life. Fast forward 20 minutes of shouting later, we have what are called converts to the way of Jenga Maker. Jenga Maker is seriously one of the best mass market games that I've played in a long time. In fact, I'm hard-pressed to think of a better one in recent memory. This was published by Hasbro in 2022. It remains uncredited. We do not approve of this policy of not crediting game designers. It is not a good look. I think you should shape up, Hasbro. But anyway, in Jenga Maker, you divide into two equal teams. One player gets to see what you're building, and what you're building is being built out of very, very simple block shapes, but they're shockingly evocative. They're really cool in terms of what you're building. We had someone on a motorbike. We had someone reading a book. There's a whole bunch of different animal and object shapes, and sometimes you can intuit based on the design, but once you know what the design is meant to evoke, you can clearly see what they were going for, and they're just really inventive and neat, and there are these two massive decks of objects, one basic, one advanced. And then the shouter, as I call them, has to instruct their teammates, however many that may be. We played with six, which works very, very well, actually. Better than I thought it would. First time I'd ever played with six. About how to construct the object, but they're not allowed to point, and they're not allowed to say what the thing is. They merely have to use the rest of their words. Two observations from my recent most excellent play of Jenga Maker. I adore Jenga Maker. I'll play it at any opportunity. Number one, had vastly fewer frustrating instances, satisfyingly frustrating, of trying to find many new ways to misinterpret rotate, because that is often a word that is deployed frequently, and it's like, no, not that way. Rotate it the other way. No, I don't mean that other way. That other way. Rotate it. The other thing that I found striking was that sometimes when you play a game with a new group of people, you see it played in a different way. And in this particular case, I had a number of builders who had the intuition. I'm not saying this is better or worse. It's just different from how I approach the game. Who felt that a good first step was to set out the inventory of pieces from which you were going to build it. Because every card, it partially, I think, to facilitate this style of play, but also partially to facilitate the other team verifying that the build is accurate, lists all the blocks that are involved. It's like, okay, this has two pink, one blue, one of the yellow, both of the natural colors, whatever. And when I am the shouter, I just tell people to take pieces as they are added to the edifice. But these shouters decided to start off by saying, okay, take both of the white, take one of the blue, take one of the yellow, and then we have the pile of things we built from. My intuition when I first experienced it was that this was going to be a giant waste of time. In practice, we still won those rounds. And so I don't know. Now I'm just curious. What do you think, community of Jenga makers?
It makes you familiar with the pieces you're going to be using, I suppose.
I don't know. It's just, like I say, I thought it was going to be a time sink, and then it just seemed somehow to facilitate the building in a way that was almost imperceptible. I don't know. I'm curious. Long story short, I wish to play more Jenga Maker. I wish to expose more people to the glory of Jenga Maker. Far too many hobbyist gamers. I don't think many people who listen to this show, fortunately, but far too many hobbyist gamers look down their nose at playing with toys. One of the greatest things about this hobby is that it lets us play with toys. Jenga Maker is awesome.
Agreed. Now for something that's not awesome, Mark. Uwe Rosenberg has never failed us before, but on Board Game Arena, there is a game called Click-A-Tree by Uwe Rosenberg. And what you're doing is they have this sort of circle of tiles, and there are trees. And in between the trees are fruits of trees. And so you pick the fruit, and you get the tiles on either side. And then you start building this, you know, hexagon sort of player area of trees. And you want to get certain groups together, because there's this whole sideboard that says, you know, get three of A trees together, three B trees, all these different things. And then after you place your two tiles, then you're going to have to take this harvest tile. And they're going to have axes on them on different sides. And depending on where you put it, you're going to harvest the groups of trees that are together. So if the axe touches the figs and the cherries, then I add up all my figs and cherries. And I put that up the scoreboard and I use that to, you know, maybe buy more tiles or something later. Anyway, this is the first time on Board Game Arena where the players actively asked if we could stop playing the game.
Really? That bad, huh?
It was that bad.
Wow.
It was not enjoyed by anyone there, including me.
What was so unsatisfying about it?
It was just very unsatisfying. It was boring. It was just like, okay, obviously I want to do this, so I'm going to pick those two tiles and I'm going to put them like that because that's what the sideboard says. Okay.
I see.
Now you get to do the same thing.
You felt that the game played itself more or less. Yeah.
It was not interesting in the least. But you guys can be the judge. You can try it on Board Game Arena. It's on there now. It is called Click-A-Tree. By Uwe Rosenberg.
Are you sure it's smart to encourage our listeners to judge anything? Because I find it best when people accept what we say uncritically.
Oh, true. Obviously, we're right. And we know more than they do.
Look, whether we're right or not is not the point. The point is we can't have them starting wondering whether what they're listening to is of any value. Because I don't think that ends well for
true,
us.
True.
Ultimately. Got to play Street Masters, Tide of the Dragon. Now, Board Game Geek says that this design was finished in 2022, and indeed it was published at that time, and since then, for the most part, it's been sitting in a Chinese warehouse, or a series of Chinese warehouses, because of the sundry business problems of the publisher Blacklist Games. Anyway, none of that is of consequence to me anymore, because I finally have the thing, and now I can ignore that Blacklist Games ever existed, because now my huge Street Masters box is full. And That's an extra reason not to have to be tempted by any future offerings of Blacklist Games. If they happen to release any more Street Masters content, which they might or might not try, Walker had a very good reaction to that prospect, which was basically, who would trust them with money ever again from now on? Well, we'll see. Board gamers have proven to be a trusting lot where toys are concerned. QV previous comments about toys. Upside and downside for being obsessed with toys, I gotta say. The long story short. Anyway, so Tide of the Dragon is the latest expand-alone for the Street Master series. The Street Master series is kind of sort of a miniatures game adaptation of a Sentinels of the Multiverse kind of format, where you have a bunch of modular heroes, a modular stage, and a modular villain. Although in this case, there's a spatial element to Street Masters, which helps actually, you might think that would make it more cumbersome than Sentinels of the Multiverse, but I would actually maintain that in many instances, Street Masters is easier to execute than Sentinels of the Multiverse because by virtue of the spatial element, you don't have to worry about who has the highest hit points or the second lowest hit points or the third smallest prime number of hit points or whatever to determine targeting. Targeting is determined by who is most proximate, and that is much more straightforward because the map is usually very circumscribed. On top of that, it's playing with a whole bunch of tropes from the beat-em-up and fighting game video game genres, both of which I am very enthusiastic about. And so Street Masters Tide of the Dragon being the latest thing introduces new stages, new bosses, new characters, new stuff. Mixed it in with gusto with my existing Street Master stuff. My Street Master's box is now exceptionally heavy, but still portable. And brought it over and played it with a couple of the Louis. And I got to try one of the new characters who, sure enough, is very interesting. She plays with tactics cards in a way that we haven't seen before. She's a Wing Chun practitioner. Her name is Phoenix. And she has reactions. Most characters don't have reactions. When you get attacked, you just get attacked and you either use your defense tokens or you don't. But after the attack is done, she gets to use one of the available reactions she's built up in her tableau, and then that card gets discarded. But a lot of her other abilities allow her to fish cards from her discard pile and put them back into play, so she can cycle through her reactions in that way. The downside to playing Phoenix is that she's weak on the offense. She just doesn't have a whole lot of offensive capability, especially when compared to the other characters. Most other characters, their default attack lets them roll two dice. Her default attack lets her roll one die. So she's stronger on the defense than she's in the offense. But often I like characters like that. So she was very interesting. We played on a new stage. It was a helipad. It was very cool. We were buffeted by winds. People were in danger of getting thrown off the edge of the building. And played against a new gang. The new gangs are very, very clearly inspired by East Asian action movie stars. The caricature of Donnie Yen is unmistakable in terms of all the art. But that's okay. That's kind of the Street Masters vibe. I'm happy with them riffing on existing tropes, as I said, in the context of video games. So I think it would be somewhat churlish to now say, well, now you're doing it with movies and I don't like it as much. That's fine. I love the system. I love playing the system. I love trying out the new things in the system. I love finding out new combinations. Street Masters has been a perennial favorite ever since it was published, at least in my household. I'm a huge fan. We'll play any time, even though, as far as I'm concerned, sadly, business shenanigans have made the product line finished. But at least it is finished with a lot of stuff. So that was my experience with Street Masters, specifically with the latest Tide of the Dragon expansion.
Now for a good game that I played on Board Game Arena, this is called Crafting the Cosmos, designed by David Gordon and Tam, and put out by Office Dog. And in this game, you are building the universe. So what first thing you do is you manipulate these marbles, and it's going to tell you all of the goodies you're going to get. It'll tell you like how many stars you get to put out, how you get to manipulate the stars, how many sort of life organisms you can populate around, and then you're going to use all of this stuff that you got from manipulating the marbles to start putting it out on the board and most effectively bringing these planets to life, right? You need a certain number of stars. The planet will tell you what stars it needs around it, and then you need to surround it with life to get the bonus points, and then you move the stars around your board to the other planets that you're now developing. Anyway, it's a great sort of puzzle game where you're trying to get the most out of the stuff you get every round with all sorts of special abilities that you're going to get from cards that also come from the marble blitz. Anyway, definitely a game to try out. It is also out now in the stores. It's called Crafting the Cosmos. Super colorful, very lots of decisions to make, very interesting sort of move the marbles around, figure out which, you know, what you need for that round, what's the best way to get it, and puzzling it all out.
Do you have a physical copy incoming?
I do not.
Oh, Walker.
I'm just I just have so many. I just don't know if I need yet another box for the pile.
That's fair. Played a game of Scapegoat. This is by John Perry, king of the small box games, as far as we're concerned. John Perry has also designed Air, Land, and Sea, as well as Time Barons, several other things besides. Scapegoat is his social deduction game, and it is an interesting take on social deduction in that it is much faster and much less verbal than a lot of social deduction games. Now, keep in mind, I am more than happy to spend 2 hours yelling at people in the context of a social deduction game. But I also quite like this more minimalistic approach, frankly. This is a game about paranoia. This is a game about deciding whether or not everyone's out to get you. Because at the start of the game, everyone knows who the scapegoat is. Except the scapegoat, who thinks that somebody else is the scapegoat. And the goal of the scapegoat is to sell everyone out to the police. And the job of everyone else is to successfully frame the scapegoat for the robbery that you all just collectively performed. Now, I have to say that this was probably one of the best plays I've seen by the scapegoat in some time. Very often the scapegoat wins by accident because, again, there's a mood of paranoia, and if anybody runs to the cops because they think they're the scapegoat, then the scapegoat wins whether or not that person was the one who ran to the cops. So the number of accidental scapegoat wins we've seen have been rather high. I'm okay with that. I don't need social deduction games to be particularly well balanced, so long as they sell the mood correctly. But Walker, why don't you walk us through your past master scapegoat victory?
I think it was just a bad choice because there's no way for the other players. I was the scapegoat. I was told that Red was the scapegoat, and there was no way. I'm just wondering how much it would change the game if it also told you. I was blue. So that everyone said blue was the scapegoat, but blue thinks that red's the scapegoat. I wonder if they gave you that little bit of extra information, whether that would make it infinitely harder or whatever. So, but unfortunately that's the way it went, you know, just second turn in to the game. I'm thinking red is the scapegoat, but then someone discarded a red card, which I thought was odd. Like, why would they discard a red card if we're trying to frame red?
Well, so as defeated to somebody else.
As defeated somebody else.
But then you foreclosed that possibility.
Yeah, so then immediately it was my turn next. So I said, well, I'll just look at their hand. And if they don't have a red card in their hand and they just threw away their only red card, then something's up. And sure enough, I looked at their hand. They had no red. Didn't make sense. And someone had just passed them a card as well. And so none of that jived. And so I took the chance and went to the police.
No, it was good.
And they saved me.
No, you're entirely right. The fact that, as the majority group, we don't know who you think in error is the patsy does kind of constrain our ability. So, but there are a number of things that we can do to try to make the scapegoat feel safe, like passing them their own color card, for example. So there's a variety of ways to shift cards around. The way a successful frame job is executed in Scapegoat is for everyone else to have a card of the scapegoat's color when the time comes to do the frame job. So here we all are trying to accumulate blue cards, and Walker notices that people are shedding other colors, and that doesn't necessarily make sense. Now, the job then, therefore, is to try to bring the scapegoat on side, and there are a number of ways to do that, but if you don't know who they suspect, that gets difficult. Not impossible, but difficult. And navigating that is just one of the challenges of being the majority party in Scapegoat. It's just baked into the design. I love Scapegoat. It's great. It's a lovely change of pace from a lot of the standard social deduction conventions, but nonetheless maintaining that degree of tension. Actually, the mere fact that you're allowed to say whatever you want, whenever you want, it leads to mostly just tense silence because anything you say is just going to be open to the entire table. I frequently find that the only thing that makes any sense is to say, so are we good to go? And then just make eye contact with everyone. And then hope that that's going to be enough and that people are on the same page. Although I have to say, I should probably stop saying that because most of the time when I say, so we're good to go, that has prompted somebody to go to the cops by accident. Anyway, I adore Scapegoat. This is a review copy we got from the designer. And I am happy to play at any time. It is very quick, very enjoyable, and very different from other social deduction games. Indeed, Final Chaser, by virtue of the fact that there's so little talking, I often find that this is the social deduction game for people who don't like social deduction games. That and the goat puns are pretty amusing.
It's true. And the art is hilarious.
Yeah, I think the goats are pretty cute.
So we got a trio of games for review copies from Bitewing Games. Two of them are designed by
Robert Hovakamian.
And the third one is designed by Reiner Knizia. We played two of them so far. The one I played in stream this week, so you can check it out on our live page on YouTube. It's called Shuffle and Swing. Like I said, it's put out by Bitewing, and it's hard to sort of explain what's going on. You are mice managers managing cats.
So you're micromanagers.
Micromanagers, mini micromanagers.
Yep.
That are managing cats building musical instruments. Obviously makes sense. Stick with me.
Why would Here mice be managing cats? That's like a podcast edited by Gibbons.
I don't know.
Okay.
So I guess the board is divided up into three sections. So there's an instrument for each section that needs to get built. And it's a worker placement. So you move to a section if there's a free spot. And then you get to place a die. So there's some dice worker placement as well at the same time. So you have to also use a die in the section that you moved your worker to. You have one worker that moves around this board. When it goes to a section, you have to activate a die. So you're either taking one of your dice that is off the board and placing it in a section in that map, if there's room. Or you get to activate one of your dice that are already there. Or you can activate someone else's die. And depending on whose dice you activate, they're going to get a cat worker that can be used to build an instrument. The interesting part is that in a given section, the color of cat you get cannot be used to build that instrument. So you're always having to move around to get cats from different places. One of the actions you can do there is build the instrument. Another one is to rest. That's going to get some of your cat workers back, and the other one is to have an inspector move around the instrument, because you put little tokens out to show which parts of the instrument that you've built, scoring. Interesting parts are that the dice keep ticking up, and they get turn into advanced dice, and they won't go down. They go down to a 2 minimum after a while, and so they're, because it's going to tell you how many times you get to do that action. The other interesting part are the cat workers. Say that part of the instrument takes 3 cat workers, orange ones. You spend them, they go on this little quilt board that you have.
Wait. Sorry, you're right.
We've already learned from Calico that cats go on quilts, Mark. This is a board game standard.
No, I get it. Cats go on quilts, but these are cats.
Unless they get booped off.
What's going on?
Okay, so you use the cats to build the instrument. They go on your quilt, and that's why you need to take the rest action, because also on your quilt, they go from, 1 to 4. Same thing, you use the die, and you get to use the column or the row, and you get to get those cat workers back. Anyway, it's another nice, really interesting puzzle. Lots of different instruments that you can put out for the whole game, and they all score differently, like most, least. Anyway, it's hard to get into. I'm not going to, explain the entire game. But I really like the puzzle element of it. I like the fact that you get to upgrade dice. It's very, am I going to let that person get cat workers by choosing their dice? And not only that, their die now increases. I got locked out a lot of spaces because sometimes the inspector action can be so big, very large, because like I said, you mark which parts of the instrument you built. And when you do the inspector action, you move a little mouse figure around that instrument and you get the points again. Anyway. There has to be a die there for you to do it, and there has to be a place for your worker there to actually do the action. So every time I wanted to do it, unfortunately, that section was full and or there was no die in the inspector area to do it.
So it's a jazz-themed game about labor management.
Yes.
I already know that I'm not disco, and now I'm definitely certain that I am also not jazz.
Not jazz?
Yeah, I don't...
Speaking of jazz. The second game we got from Bitewing is called Bebop. It is about selling tickets to a outdoor jazz festival. And it is a very different game than anything we've played in quite a while.
So it's a tiling, area majority-ish, area control-ish kind of thing. The core of the game is very simple. You're either reserving a spot or you're filling a spot with a die. And the dice come in a variety of colors and have a variety of symbols. The color represents what family the die belongs to. And the symbol represents what instrument they particularly like in a jazz performance. Trumpets, drums, or piano. And that part is all very straightforward and very easy to understand. You can reserve a space or fill a space, and sometimes you want to just be eating up territory on the board. Sometimes you care more about what that territory is going to be representing in terms of the dice. That part is okay. I liked that driving element of the tension. I did not understand what was going on in Bebop. I don't think I was alone. Huey seemed to express the same thing. I had a very difficult time internalizing how to achieve success. The scoring rules by themselves are reasonably straightforward. I constantly forgot what the tiebreaker conditions were, but they weren't particularly baroque, so I'm willing to put that at my feet rather than game design. The trick is that you're surrounding these stages, and when a stage is surrounded by filled seats, then it goes to whoever has the most of a given symbol. But it's not just what's adjacent to them. Adjacency can be extended by dice of the same color. So, if I have a string of yellow dice of whatever instrument aficionados...
Or anybody, just a string of yellow.
Any string of yellow, then tying over to these drum enthusiasts that are way back on the other side of the festival grounds, they will help me win a drum token anywhere where that string of yellow touches. Now, part of my confusion is thematic in nature. I don't quite understand why, you know, members of a given family, they're all communicating. Like, are they passing by telegraph or by broken telephone? The quality of the jazz performance? Like, oh no, he's drumming really good. And the people back are like, wow, he's drumming really good. I don't know. I don't understand.
It's all about family.
Thank you, Walker. Thank you very much. It's important to remember that it's all about family. That part's one thing. But I was just really... I found it very counterintuitive. Now, whether that's a good sign or a bad sign, I don't know. I'm mostly just in a state of confusion as it is. What are your thoughts, Walker?
No, I was the same. That's why when I was teaching it, I wanted to read it right from the book and go over it a couple times because it is, like I said at the beginning, it's very different than almost anything else. It's like sometimes it matters that you have dice there and sometimes it doesn't, and you want to start building a majority here because there's also end game scoring where you're marking groups of colored dice to be the biggest. And just those groups are going to score at the end as well. And that's going to be based on how many tokens you've gathered by completing stages and having
this multi-tiered scoring
system.
You're fighting over tokens, but it's not exactly clear how much those tokens are going to be worth. And then you're fighting in a different kind of majority elsewhere, but it's still participating in the first kind of majority. I didn't really get a solid sense of what was going on, except by the very end. By the very end, when it was a question of just one or two placements left, I was able to, again, because the scoring conditions themselves are pretty transparent. When most of the other scoring conditions had already been scored, and there was no longer really competition over that anymore, I could be like, oh, I really want to place this symbol there, because I know how it affects endgame scoring. The problem is, insofar, and this occurred a couple of other times in the middle of the game as well, while we were jockeying for largest groups of family, because you want the largest family of a given color to have lots of your seats in it, because that helps you with endgame scoring as well. That part I understood. I didn't know the precise parameters of what I was fighting for. I just knew it was good, right? But during those junctures, the color and symbol on a die matters a whole heck of a lot. Now, fortunately, every time you reserve a space on the board without putting a die, you can re-roll one of the dice that's out in front of you. But that will only help you with symbol, that will not help you with color. And there were a number of inflection points over the course of the game of Bebop where it was very crucial who got what color of die when. And those moments felt pretty arbitrary because it was just a question of what happened to be available or what got disgorged from the bag. And it ended up being... Well, fortunately, it didn't end up being too consequential, but it might have been consequential if the scores had been slightly different. That part I felt a little unsatisfying.
True. I think that started at the beginning because you and I, for whatever reason, well, because we had never played before, went hard into the same color in two different areas.
Well, look, I started in that family, and then you started to horn in on that family.
Yes,
so I don't know.
Then I made a better family. Yes, agreed.
Oh, we're ranking families now. Okay, fine.
And so, and like you said... And that wasn't only us. That happened in other areas as well.
Yep.
So there was colors that didn't matter and other colors that mattered a lot.
Yeah.
Whereas if we play again, I think we'll spread it out more and realize that the mix is fairly standard and there's not going to be more of one color. So fighting someone for the largest family might not be the greatest idea and just starting in a different color would be better.
Right. Of course. And that's one of the reasons why I'd like to play again, just so I can try to get a better handle on what's going on and how I'm competing for what. The trick is that part of that would rest on knowing the number of available dice. Like, it just so happened that while I thought we were still fighting over the size of the family, and indeed some of my plays were motivated by that, all those dice were gone. I didn't know that, though. I'd need to know the distribution. And again, that's just a weird kind of cap, and that's kind of the knowledge that I'd like to know. Look, it's not a great fault that in this hobby where much of the time we play a game once and then we're done with it, that this is a game that I think needs subsequent plays, and Bebop will probably make more sense on a second play. I'm looking forward to that second play. I'd like to discover how I feel about Bebop, because right now all I feel is confusion, which is not really a rating that you can give it on BoardGameGeek.
Yeah, I'm just really enjoying it because it's so different. I'm not sure if it's a really good game or not a good game. I'm intrigued by how different it plays than other games.
Well,
or that it scores. So,
yeah, well, that's just it. Like, when you're playing it, that's not where the difference manifests. It's just you don't. It's hard to internalize the consequences of what you're doing. That's often not the balance that I'd like in terms of novelty. But we'll see. That's Bebop, another game by Robert Havakimen, published by Bitewing Games. They had a trio of games. The third one is another jazz themed
blues
jazz. Animal themed.
And it's the only reprint.
Yes. And we'll be playing that before too long, I have no doubt. Got to play a game of El Grande by Wolfgang Kramer and Richard Ulrich. Then this played no small part in terms of the inspiration of this week's topic, I am sure. I once again raised the prospect of playing El Grande with the Intrigue in the King expansion, but sadly, it is at its best when people are somewhat experienced with the base game, and I'm not really able to get El Grande to the table often enough to convince people to give that a shot, but whatever, we'll work on that later. So instead, what we did was we played with the base game cards, where you're navigating a sea of chaos in terms of what actions come up. Now, this didn't end up being too abusive. Sometimes you get card outcomes that feel a little harsh to one player or another. As it is, the pain was evenly distributed this time, fortunately. We had Louis, who desperately wanted to raid all our cubes all the time and make us lose all the cubes on the supply, and we were jockeying over core events. The mobile scoreboards didn't come out until later in the game, which is actually something I like very frequently. If one of the mobile scoreboards comes out early, that can just change the dynamics of the board in a way that is not necessarily to my preference. All of this having been said, El Grande is a marvelous area majority game, super interactive. You're always up in everyone's business, very confrontational in a very satisfying Euro way. And it has stood the test of time for a good reason. It's just that good. If you have any enthusiasm for area majority games and you haven't played El Grande, I highly recommend it. There have been a variety of different editions in and out of print. It was originally published in 1995 by Hans and Gluck. Rio Grande did a bunch of editions, and then Z-Man did some. Anyway, I prefer cubes to meeples, but that's just a personal preference. And a number of people observed, which is, I think, a fair observation. So it's easy to forget how good El Grande is. It's one of those things where, you know, the bland box and the setting, and you don't really remember how good the card play is and how good the board play is. But every time El Grande hits the table, I'm satisfied. And I think that is true of a number of other people as well.
Yeah, it's very much about balance, because how well balanced those action cards are. Because you flip up the action cards that can be played that round, and then you get to pick a card from your hand. And not only is this card going to let you either choose first or somewhere in between, the faster you play, the less people you're going to get into your supply. So that's a great decision. And also on the action cards themselves, the more powerful they are, the less troops you get to put on the board. And so figuring out the balance there, what is best for you at this moment, knowing that, you know, you're going to be able to choose later in the round, that there's going to be less choice there, knowing when at that time which card is best for you. These are the things that are great about El Grande.
Normally, the way I play El Grande, I run out of cubes by around turn 8 or 9. And frequently when I play El Grande, I end up somewhere near the bottom of the of the score ranking. This time, though, you know, I commented that I can't remember the last time I did this well in a game of El Grande, and I had only played about half of my total cubes. Part of that, I think, is just because I had Galicia. Galicia was my home territory, and it scored about 3 or 4 times before any change happened to the region, before anything came in and anything came out. So neglect, of course, is always a good way to do well in area majority games, but you can't count on it. I think there's something to that, though. I spent a lot of time agonizing over my card choices. You know, sometimes I would pick first or second, and I would pick the two or three card, foregoing the four or five card. I think maybe that's my problem. I think normally when I'm playing El Grande, that one of those tensions that you alluded to, I just fail to make the correct decision to be like, more is better. Five cubes every time, and then I run out of cubes, but I'm still not winning enough points because I've just put them in bad places because I haven't exerted the power as well. So maybe that's, you know, maybe this is a life lesson learned, Walker. That is El Grande the Big by Wolfgang Kramer and Richard Ulrich.
Lastly for me, just playing more Crokinole. Glad I got my Crokinole board. Played a lot of that this week. This is made in Canada, designed by Canada.
Designed by Canada. Published by Canada. You're a publication, Canada.
So Crokinole is very just standard. You have this round ring, you know, center in the middle, then a bigger one.
Most rings are round. Ring is not really...
You're flicking discs.
They don't fit on the finger well. It's just awful.
If there's no discs on the board, then you're free to flick it towards the center. If it lands in the center, that's 20 points. You put it off to the side. If your opponent has a disc on the board, then you have to make contact with it. Or one of your opponent's discs must move if they're on the board. Regardless of how many other things that bounce around or whatever happens.
Oh, I see.
One of their discs must move during your turn.
I thought you were making allusion to, like, blowing on it really hard or something.
No. Anyway, lots to like about Crokinole. I can see it being played a lot more.
I'm always confused about how... Frankly, this is just a weird side observation. I'm always a little uncertain about how to say the word. Is the L just fully silent?
Yes.
Just 100%?
Everyone hates the L.
No, but... No, I mean it. Like, is it actually silent or is it just sublimated?
I don't know officially. But
okay.
I've never heard it.
Well, there's no official. I mean,
I've never heard anyone speaking of official. Oh my goodness, how many different rule sets are there for Crokinole?
Really?
Like for scoring? It's like I don't know which ones to use.
Oh, okay.
I've read the one that in the book that came with the board, and then you know four different sites, and it's all different ways to score.
Huh?
It's so weird.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not uncommon with traditional games.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure that Pinochle, which is another traditional game with which you're familiar, has a whole bunch of regional variations. But I, for some reason, I had no idea that Crokinole had such
variations. The playing is always the same. The
yes.
rules for the game. But it's just how to score.
Hmm.
Like, whether... It seems though the tournament scoring seems to be fairly standard. It doesn't matter the difference in points. Like, you could blow out a game and it doesn't matter. You just get 2 points for winning the game. It's like, it seems to be like first to five or play six games and whoever gets the most points, as in 2 points for winning, not like actual points.
Right. You score points during a round and whoever wins the round gets 2 points, sort of the overall victory.
But then there's a few rules that I read where you actually do. And that what came with the game was a scoreboard that tracks the points that come on the board.
Oh.
And I'm just like, okay.
I don't know why you need that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
well, that's what I'm saying, because some of the scoring methods were actually tracking. You keep the score that's on the board, and whoever gets the most points.
Oh, I see. I misunderstood.
Yeah.
What about tennis scoring? Just make things weird and...
Yes. Completely arbitrary.
Yeah.
No, I've never heard anyone else call anything else but Crokinole.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah, because Crokinole is not really as big a thing in French Canada. I'm not saying it's not played there. I'm saying it's more of an English Canada thing. So
gotcha.
In many ways, I feel like a foreigner in my own country. So that is Crokinole, a cultural experience, a linguistic phenomenon, a scoring controversy. All of these things in one. We're now going to take a brief break to pay some bills.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
And we're back. And now on to the news and why it doesn't matter.
Well, we know Phantom Division is back on the slate. The Phantom Division is the follow-up game from the only game that matters, SEAL Team Flicks. This is a science fiction version of that. It had come to crowdfunding, but was removed and promised to come back, and it will be coming back. So look forward to that.
I have very serious editorial reservations about what we're going to do when Phantom Division is released. Will SEAL Team Flix remain the only game that matters? Will it be among the two games that matter? Well, it's we have to make a decision.
Yeah, there'll be a committee.
Yeah, we're going to strike a committee and see what's going on. All right. I'll let the Gibbons know. Early registration for SwagCon continues. Congrès, so very wrong about games. Fun times, good vibes only. Trans Rights and Human Rights Board Game Jamboree. Working title. So if you're a patron, you can go visit the Patreon page, and there is a post that you can purchase that will allow you to get early registration. And it's shaping up to be a pretty good turnout. I'm very, very pleased. And general registration will be opening up soon. Pay attention to this space, and we will let you know.
Mark, you and I both enjoy HeroScape. So I'm wondering what we both know. You know what I'm about to talk about.
I know.
But I have some reservations, right? Because never before in the HeroScape ecosystem was there a IP. Like, there was D&D.
But there was no,
Dritz. Or there was no, like, actual characters. There was just, like...
That's true.
There was just Lizard Man, right? but now...
How dare you impugn Lizard Man? Lizard Man is my favorite character from fiction.
But now we are going to get G.I. Joe HeroScape.
Yes.
Which is a two-sided
coin. I think you're missing something, Walker. When you and most of our friends start talking about movies, you don't talk about movies, you talk about Marvel. And there was Marvel HeroScape.
Right.
The
right.
only culture that exists, the monoculture, is Marvel. And there was Marvel HeroScape, and that was the set that most people hated.
Yeah, well, because it was the one that you really couldn't mix. You could
It was not a good HeroScape set.
No.
I would argue that many of the Marvel movies are similarly not particularly good, but no, apparently that's an unacceptable opinion in today. Well, actually, no, it's more acceptable now. Now it's okay. What was the one with the glove? Pre-Infinity War, this is not a popular opinion, but now people are coming around. Anyway, so yes, there's going to be HeroScape G.I. Joe.
So I can.
What are your misgivings?
Well, just because, you know, suddenly introducing IPs, right? And now where
I think
is it going to go?
Right in. I mean, frankly.
G.I. Joe will, I think.
Like, Sergeant Drake and Duke seem to be definitely of a set. I could definitely see Cobra Commander fighting with that orc riding a T-Rex. The Marrow would absolutely fit in as a G.I. Joe villain with all those snake-based freaks.
I agree. G.I. Joe is a great fit.
I think it fits really well.
Renegade Games also owns Transformers.
I know.
So although it would be great that Transformers were in HeroScape, it would be a Marvel problem, or it would be something that just wouldn't make
I don't care. I don't care. You're right. You're 100% right.
I
cannot dispute the truth of what you're saying. I don't care.
I agree with you.
I want Ultra Magnus. I want the Ultra Magnus figure to just tower over everyone. I want all his stats to be a billion. I want to have range a billion dice. I want them to have two minis, one in vehicle mode that you only use when moving, and then they stand up as a robot. Yeah, that's what I want.
I'd rather be the other way. I'd rather them be just foolishly underpowered, right? just so they'd fit in, right? You know what I mean? That they wouldn't be the Marvel problem.
Okay, tell you what, we can compromise. Some of them, like Cliffjumper and Bumblebee, get to be ridiculously underpowered and can be smacked around even by your average Krav Maga agent from the first HeroScape set.
Gotcha.
I want my Ultra Magnus.
Okay. All the dice that you can find.
Yeah.
Understood.
Roll as many dice as you need until the thing is paced. Oh, actually, I shouldn't actually do, because most representations of Ultra Magnus, he underperforms. It's just the nature of things. I like Ultra Magnus not because he's powerful, but because I see myself in him. He's the second in command that fails at leadership. And that has absolutely been a lesson that I've had to relearn over and over. I'm a pretty good 2IC. I'm a very bad leader. And that's Ultra Magnus to a T. Optimus Prime, certainly Megatron, certainly most of the fighter jets. Yeah, they would be ridiculously overpowered. Just move wherever you want to. Roll as many dice as you need. Nobody can touch you.
Yeah,
there you go.
They can't fire back. You're already gone.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, but all joking aside, I would... nothing could compel me to re-enter the HeroScape market more than some Transformers.
I'm going to have to buy. I'm going to see how many G.I. Joe sets they put out.
Yeah.
And maybe cherry pick them or, yeah. Anyway.
Absolutely. Was Cherry Picker the name of a G.I. Joe?
I'll have to check. Probably. Eventually.
You get like a high sniper's nest or something?
Came with a lemur, you know, because all G.I. Joe guys have a pet, right?
So, not all of them, but a fair number do. Yeah, that's true. Oh, geez. I'll never forget that multi-part episode where that sailor dude with the stupid hat and the parrot was being subjected to brainwashing. And it was just really horrific for a young child. Do you remember the one I'm talking about?
No, I do not.
Yeah, okay. I don't even remember the character's name. He had a beard, and they were messing with his head. They invented a fake family that he never had. Oh, but the conditioning was getting warped, so sometimes he'd have these nightmares where they melted into ooze. It was just really scary for a young child.
Yeah, and Robot Chicken has a great G.I. Joe and Their Pets episode.
Oh, yeah?
It's very funny.
Okay.
Yes.
CMYK, the game publisher who has most recently put out the most excellent Magenta line of card games, is going to now have a game show, which is interesting. So this is going to
like
be called...
a TV. Like, just so we're clear, a TV Price is Right.
Wow. Let's not necessarily elevate to the level
of the
GOAT.
I just mean like a syndicated...
We can all agree that Price is Right is the GOAT of game shows,
Oh,
right?
For sure, yes.
Especially because it is a consumer product about consumer products to win consumer products.
Just so.
It completes the Ouroboros eating its own tail. But it's going to be hosted by Deborah Norville from Dateline. And this is a game called Perfect Line. And the credited game designers from CMYK is the same design team from Wavelength. Alex Haig, Justin Vickers, and Wolfgang Varsch. Very talented people. I'm curious.
Yeah.
Game shows aren't really my thing, but it is the case that good game design is a good game design. And on occasion, I've seen the premise for a game show and thought they could have used some game designers working on
that. Yeah, it all seems very usual. It's usually completely random, guessing numbers and...
Yeah.
Things that don't matter, and I'd be interested to see if there's some sort of structure there and skill. That'd be very interesting.
Absolutely. And I guess maybe just to complete the package, you then have Perfect Line, the home version. I wonder if CMYK would do such a thing. I don't know.
Maybe.
Anyway, that's
probably
Perfect
one of these
Line.
Things, one of these
CBS,
things, depending on
CMYK?
How popular it is.
Of course,
right?
Of course.
Lots of people like Ark Nova, Mark. So Mathis Wiggy, the designer, is putting out a new sort of the next iteration, and the English version will be called Sanctuary. And this looks like more board than card game. But same sort of animal, you know, design, zoo, area, tiles. Something different, but the same. Sanctuary. So I'll be interested to try it. Also, Blizzard has decided to bring StarCraft back to the tabletop. First, with a miniature game. So there's going to be a StarCraft miniature game in 2026. And they say it's going to be followed by actual StarCraft board games in 2027. So we'll see. That might be interesting. And lastly from me, in the latest Alley Cat Games crowdfunding update, they have said that they're no longer going to be bringing any of their crowdfunding games to retail. All of the Alley Cat games will now be crowdfunding only. So that's something interesting, yeah.
Interesting.
And that is the news from this week and why it doesn't matter. Now on to our feature topic of the week, which is games from the 20th century.
Remember in the good old days when candy was sweeter and everything tasted better and games were all... Everything was better in the old days?
Remember Tigers and Euphrates? You remember?
I remember Tigers and Euphrates. You remember El Grande? I remember El Grande. No. I just want to say, even in philosophy, there's this appeal to the golden age that is a common rhetorical and sometimes substantial conceit. I have no patience for it.
No.
It doesn't do anything for me. There was a lot of dreck published more than 25 years ago. But there's a kind of aesthetic that I think is very characteristic of a bunch of games, especially in the last 5 years. Of the 20th century, that is very characteristic, and I think more to the point, it's mischaracterized by a lot, and it's evident. There's a lot of stuff going on. There's verbal shift going on. What constitutes a euro is in flux. Anyway, there's a lot to talk about here. What are some of the characteristic games that you think of, Walker, when you think of the late 20th century euro, or like early 20th? I don't know. If you know some euros from the 1920s, please let me know. But
well, I do. I went down. After I made the list and realized that every game I put on the list was from the 1990s.
Yep.
Which, oh my goodness. I did go down and I have a game from every decade.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That
Decade or every year in the decade?
No, I didn't do 100. I did not do 100 games. I did 10 games. So one game from every...
That's lazy. Go ahead.
Do you want to go through those first?
No.
No, okay. So, games I've that from 20th Century I have, like we already talked about, Tigers and Euphrates has very much the trappings of a Euro.
Well, but that's just it. What
of,
that
of
meant
from them,
yeah,
from
yeah.
that time.
What Euro meant in the 20th century is radically different from what Euro
means
now.
I don't think there's any such thing as Euro now.
I would disagree with you, but okay, finish your thought. I'm sorry to have interrupted. What elements that Tigers and Euphrates has would say is characteristic of the 20th century Euro for you?
Very sort of confrontational, very sort of standard. There's no very tight rule set.
Yep.
Very point driven, very sort of intricate, multi-step type things.
Yeah, I would say, I don't know that Tigers and Euphrates is particularly characteristic of Euros ever. I will say that it is striking that tile laying games are much less prevalent now than they used to be. And this was also true in the early 21st century as well. There were more tile laying games then, I think. But of course, the ones that stand head and shoulders to me are the so-called tile laying trilogy by Rainer Knizia, Samurai, Tigers and Euphrates, Through the Desert. And to that is often appended Stevenson's Rocket, which I think is underappreciated, but at least there's slightly more exposure now, what with the reprint. And these are games that are indeed very, very confrontational. And sometimes even zero-sum confrontational, right? Tigers and Euphrates, there's the opportunity for sort of cooperation, right? You latch onto somebody else's strong kingdom. You're in green, but they're in red, and you use that other player's red position to bludgeon your opponents and further your own green interests. That's one of the reasons why the game is so brilliant. But if you look at Tigers and Euphrates, you look at Samurai, you look at a whole bunch of other tile-laying games of the era, there is no coopetition. It is all, I'm taking it so you can't go where you want to go. I've defeated you in this round. I've blocked you. I've grabbed the thing. And what we have now, just to sort of articulate my point about verbal shift, games of that level of confrontation, games of that level of head-to-head blocking and jockeying, sometimes people adduce that feature as being why a game cannot be called a Euro. So I've heard people say, oh, well, El Grande can't be a Euro. There's too much fighting involved. It's like, that's weird.
Yeah, I think there was an evolution where Euros became sort of a heads-down, tableau-building.
Precisely.
Non-interactive.
Precisely.
Type thing.
You don't see a whole lot of tableau-building in the late 1990s or even other parts of the 20th century. You don't see a whole lot of tracks. You don't see a whole lot of card combos or anything of that. And I'm not saying this necessarily makes them better. I'm just saying that this is absolutely a very strong characteristic of contemporary Euros of the past 10 years or so. And again, I just like to stress just at the outset, the definition of Euro, where it's like it's a Euro if it's designed by people from Europe, is not a particularly interesting definition. You can have that classification, that's fine, whatever. But I think increasingly, that is one area of verbal shift where I think the term has actually become more useful, not less. It's become ambiguous or agnostic as to the actual country of origin. So, whatever. Multiple taxonomies can exist at the same time, but insofar as I deploy the term, I don't really care where it comes from.
Another thing about I feel that board games from the 20th century have is a lot of them are from Germany, and they have a lot more, I don't want to say complicated, but more in-depth family weight games.
Mm.
Right, whereas family weight games during that time in North America were like Trouble and, you know, sort of bog standard roll and move,
Uno, stuff like that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's fair. Like what
Elfinland, right, is what the one I have here for that particular example. Like,
just, yeah,
like a very family weight for that time. I think it was a family weight game and a lot more in depth than you would normally see.
Yeah, same thing with even things like Hare and Tortoise from the 80s, stuff like that. Absolutely. And look, nothing against, there's lots of really, really good games that you can play with even very, very young children. But most of them, I think, are dexterity games or other forms of toy-based play. Like Animal Upon Animal, I'll throw down at any time. That's great. But in-depth, it is not.
Agreed. And like I said, 1999.
What a year.
What a year.
Yep.
Like you said, you already said Stevenson's Rocket. Mm-hmm. We got a fantastic auction and negotiation game with Raw in Chinatown.
Yeah.
Tikal also came out in 99. Roads and Boats is 99. Torres, if you haven't played it, is another very essential sort of 20th century game. You're building this very interesting giant sort of stacking castle type thing. And it's so puzzly because it allows you to manipulate your meeple through these castles and to get to different positions and trying to get area majority in these castles by just thinking and planning your moves through. What a great game.
So El Grande was designed by Wolfgang Kramer and Richard Ulrich. Kramer is known mostly for his collaborative work, but he's probably best known for a lot of the work that he did with Michael Kiesling. Right? And Kiesling and Kramer released the Mask trilogy. And on top of that, there's Torres, which is kind of sort of the fourth member of the Mask trilogy, even though it doesn't really have a mask. But it's similarly an action point-based tile-laying competitive experience. And sadly, it's probably one of the biggest lacuna in my gaming history. I've still never played Torres. I've always been meaning to. But yeah, there's all these really quality... So I mentioned the Tile Lane trilogy. There's the Mask trilogy. A whole bunch of auction games. Auctions were absolutely de rigueur in 90s hobby games. It was hard to see many games that didn't have them. Like Catan and El Grande are a couple of the standout exceptions. But auctions were just included practically everywhere. It was kind of like the equivalent of tableau building. It was just the thing that you put in to a lot of designs that just came standard. Which is not to say that some of them weren't brilliant. Like, Raw and Modern Art are absolutely stood the test of time. But frequently, auctions were just the thing. And kind of almost in a faddish way that kind of died down as the 21st century sort of flexed. And then worker placement was the thing. Although arguably, yes, I know, worker placement is a form of auction. Let us shelve that debate for another day. But there were just so many excellent series and a lot of different conventions that were being explored that we don't really do as much anymore in the hobby.
Yeah, Bus is also 1999.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Bus and Roads and Boats the same year. Yeah. Fascinating.
That's why I had to go back and make the list from, you know, 1900s and up, because every game that I use as an example of the 20th century being great were all from the 1990s.
Yeah.
And I was just like, okay, well, you know.
The explosion of hobby games was really precipitated by Catan, right?
Yes.
And again, Catan actually is one of those things that kind of had something that still has contemporary echoes, which is I would argue that the Catan economy is premised on a kind of sort of cousin to recipe fulfillment. Because that's another thing you didn't see very often in 20th century Euros and that you now see all the time. Recipe fulfillment, fulfilling orders, you need two of this and one of the other, all over the place now. But that's the defining aspect of the Catan economy, that one of the things that made it separate. But again, Catan, a highly interactive game, even if you set aside the trading, there's still a lot of blocking, a lot of interaction. And again, I find it so striking. And I don't know when the shift happened, but it definitely happened over the course of my hobby existence, where what Euro meant would preclude most of the famous Euros of the 20th century. And it's just an interesting linguistic shift.
Agreed.
Some of the things that we see from the 20th century Euros are still absolutely very, very common, like set collection and triangular scoring. These are still things you see all over the place. They were very characteristic then, still very characteristic now. And just so I can emphasize, you know, things that were very present in those Euros that I'm glad are gone for the most part, just so I don't sound like some sort of ridiculous apologist or someone drowning in nostalgia, which is that I think culturally and visually, Euro games and hobby games have evolved considerably since the games of the 90s. So in terms of cultural issues, there were dozens and dozens of games from that era, still in the 21st century as well, absolutely, that were just unapologetically colonialist, whether it's Puerto Rico, whether it's Goa, whether it's so many other games of that ilk. It was already starting to fade in popularity. There's still some. I'm not going to say it went away. But by and large, they are not nearly as common. And, you know, with that, a whole bunch of other things. No women with agency, no real people of color represented. And if they were, they didn't really have agency as well. And on top of that, generally speaking, the stereotype of the brown or sepia color palette is well earned. I mean, let's be frank, it's an accurate stereotype.
I was going to say, almost all of these games that we talked about are all based on sort of historical, you know, factions or places, you know what I mean?
It's, yeah.
There's hardly, like, no science fiction here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for a while, there was this strong belief that science fiction games didn't sell. And so a number of designs that were originally pitched to science fiction were recontextualized into what at the time was regarded as a, you know, a safer colonialist a sort of endeavor. There was a joke that my a friend I had in Massachusetts named Ted, who would say before a rules explanation, like, in this game, you build up your ancient civilization. And this was true of like half the games we played, right? It's like, raw, you're building up your ancient civilization. You're playing one of the Mask trilogy. In this game, you're building up your ancient civilization, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm glad that we're getting a little more diversity there. We're getting more also in terms of diversity of representation. We also see a greater diversity of authors, more and more women, more and more people of color, more and more people from the queer community are game designers and are in the industry. And from that, we also get a plurality of more perspectives. Like, I could not imagine a game like Molly House being published in the 20th century, which is a shame. But because they were all about historical themes, just only some historical themes.
Let me shoot through this very quickly, this list here.
Sure.
Just because there were some great games earlier in the 20th century.
100%.
Like Pit came out in 1903.
Oh, wow. I forgot how old Pit is.
Yeah. And it was a game that I had in my early thing. And we played it a lot.
Yeah,
it was
an edition with the bell?
Yes.
You got to have the bell.
You got to have the bell.
You got to have the bell.
If you don't have the bell, then you're not playing Pit.
Oh, okay.
Did you know the game that we've been talking about recently, the button soccer, the one that's still being played in Portugal with the flicking the soccer players?
Oh, yeah. Around. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is button soccer, was put out in 1911. I didn't realize it was, that's where I found it.
All these really interesting dexterity games from around the world that require elaborate bespoke tables. Like, there's Crokinole all over the place. I'm sure there's somebody in the subcontinent now. There's some Pakistani gamer who's like, oh, Crokinole, how exotic. I'm stuck with Karam. It's like, I'd love to...
let's trade.
Let's trade. I'm not saying one's better than the other. It's
no,
just, there are all
but
these
I want to try it.
Weird regional dexterity games, but you can't replicate them without the particular bespoke table. And so Walker in particular, just for context, shares videos of all these weird things he finds on the internet of, you know, the world championships of Karam or the world championships of button soccer and these people pulling off these amazing plays. I'm like, that looks like an awesome game.
Next up, they have Bridge coming in at 1925, but I'm a little skeptical.
Well, it's an evolution of Contract Whist, which is older. Formal, actual Bridge, Bridge qua Bridge, is actually a lot younger than a lot of people think.
Now, that's the other thing. Like, how would you define whether or not a card game is a Euro or not, right?
It's tricky.
It's tricky. Romoli.
Oh, sure.
1940. So we're going up by tens here. That was 20.
All right, cool.
Where am I? Oh, yeah. Okay. Clue, 1949.
Hmm.
Designed by an Englishman. That's why I put it in here. I'm like, is it a Euro? I don't know.
I don't know. So in terms of some of the design idioms, yes. In terms of some of the other design idioms, no. Like, there's no player elimination. A number of Euros have had roll to move, which Clue does. There are a number of deduction Euros. Like, Mystery of the Abbey is unambiguously a contemporary deduction Euro. So, maybe you might want to call it a proto-Euro or something like that. I don't know.
Now, here's a game that was not designed by an American. Acquire is 100% a Euro game.
Yes.
Not designed in Europe.
Absolutely, yeah. No, and Acquire, Sid Sackson.
Yeah.
Towering genius of his era, yeah.
1964. Dune in 1979.
Are you going to skip Cosmic Encounter?
Yep.
You're not? No? No Cosmic Encounter?
I don't know what that is. What is that? Is that a game? We're talking about Euro games.
No one... Well, I don't think anyone would argue that... You've been playing fast and loose with that, so don't you dare...
100%.
Yeah. No, I would never in a million years argue that Cosmic Encounter is a Euro. But it has some Euro elements in it. It is not entirely... divorced from that idiom.
The negotiation part, I feel as though that is a Euro trapping. I'm just not sure.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that some of the ingenious ways in which it channels conflict is characteristic of a Euro design idiom, like the Destiny phase, where you're told with whom to go have an encounter, and that is a way to enhance gameplay by limiting choice. And that, I think, is very much part of the design language of a contemporary Euro. The actual conflict, the fact that there's lots of conflict, again, as we've been saying, doesn't preclude it from being a Euro. The way conflict is resolved is also kind of sort of Euro-y. Like, if you look at Lord of the Rings, The Confrontation, or a lot of other games of that ilk, it's about hand management and using a better card to beat your opponent. So, anyway, I'm not going to say the Cosmic Encounter is a Euro, but I'm saying that it is, might be more of a Euro than people give it credit.
And from the 1980s, the only game that matters, Space Hulk.
You're going to skip over Civilization, then?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. You're going to skip over all the works of Francis Tresham. No 1829, no 1830, no Civilization.
Space Hulk.
Sure. No up front, nothing else.
You know, I did have up front there first. I was up front, and then it was up front slash Space Hulk, and then it was like...
Again, I wouldn't argue that these are Euros. I mean, Civilization's pretty close. The 18XX games are kind of their own thing. Again, have some Euro elements, but I mean, if we're going to do a lightning tour of game design of hobby games over the 20th century, I'm not going to let you skip Francis Tresham. That is for damn sure.
And then, like I said, all the other games we mentioned that came out in the 90s.
Yeah, it was pretty much 95. That was like the big turning point. I'm not going to argue that there weren't modern-feeling quality Euro games prior to 1995, but it's pretty much the sea change. It's pre-Catan, post-Catan. That's the big epical moment, more or less. And, you know, just the number of brilliant releases in those 5 years is just wild to me.
Yeah.
Sometimes it takes a long time for an idiom, to a new design language, a new set of ideas, or a new instantiation of those ideas to really hit their stride. And then sometimes, in some ways, they peak in the first manifestations. And I think in the context of Eurogame design, it's the latter more than the former. And this, just to sort of tie this together, in terms of this being about themes and ideas and feelings rather than, strictly speaking, a set of a time period, this is one of the reasons why when Hansa Teutonica was released, so many people, including myself, felt that it was a throwback. Even though you couldn't point to a specific design that it was exactly like, the visual language definitely. It's a very brown game. Brown and cubes, that's what you got. And mechanically, it did root connection in a way that no other game really did, either before or since. But in terms of the overall feel, a lot of people felt that Hansa Teutonica felt like it was published about 15 years too late. Like, it could have been published in the late 90s, and it would have fit in just fine with the rest of those games, and it would have felt of that time, but it also felt very much of its time when it was published as well. So
I just looked this up just now, so it would have to take up a little bit more, you know, looking into it later, but the internet became big in 1995. So I'm wondering if that also had a sort of a play in it where designers could now talk to each other and or bounce ideas off or have more of a, you know, a something to draw from.
I don't know. Yeah, that's a yeah. Good point. Yeah.
That'll have to take some more looking into, though.
Huh. All I know is that the internet's rotting our brains. It's the social medias telling me to participate in lipstick parties, which are totally a thing. So that's going to do it for this week for Silver Age Roundabout Games. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your having decided to spend the time. We hope to see you again soon. Please take care of yourselves, take care of your hobby, and thank your Rules Explainer.
Peace!
You've been listening to Silver Age Roundabout Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark McNeil. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.